This is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. I started this company because I was fed up with cheap clothes that didn't last and companies that shipped manufacturing overseas. We believed we could still make incredible clothing right here in the US with American cotton and American workers earning real wages. That's what we stand for, making clothes that actually last. Get 20% off your first order when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com.
Off the ball.
Rugby.
Did he need minutes?
No. Come back. Played the last two games. Played a long shift from Bayern. He did not need minutes. And this is not being wise after the event. I didn't want to tempt fate when the team was landed on Friday. I saw in the preview that, and then I remember looking at the first couple of, why is he at the bloody all-weather pitches? Part of me hates them.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Introducing a new Off the Ball football podcast original. Richie McCormick's Sliding Doors. These are the stories of those big money deals that just didn't quite happen.
Figo, Ronaldo. He's made space for himself. Ronaldo shot. Pick that out. What a hat trick.
Episode 1 of this podcast series focuses on Ronaldo and a move to Glasgow Rangers. Subscribe now in your OTB football podcast feed to not miss an episode of this 6-part series coming to you live each and every Monday.
The aforementioned Dara Smith-Nocton is in studio. Good morning, Dara. How are things?
Shane, good morning.
And Keith Tracy is with us this morning. Good morning, Keith.
Morning, everybody.
We're just watching as well the Australian Open men's tennis semi-final, which is ongoing. We'll keep you up to speed across the morning. But so far, Carlos Alcaraz, the Spaniard, up against Alexander Zverev of Germany. And Alcaraz leads 2-1. So he took the first set 6-4. The second set in a tiebreak 7-6. But Zverev has taken the third set in a 7-6 tiebreak as well. They are currently on serve in the fourth set at 4-4.
Shane, this is extraordinary stuff. I don't know if you've been watching this all the way through, but Alcaraz was kind of cruising until the end of the third set. And it seems that he's pulled his groin or some type of inner thigh injury. It's kind of hard to tell, but he's been limping for the last like 7 or 8 games, really. Nearly took the third set, which would have been remarkable.
Mm.
But he's right in this last set as well. It's absolutely ridiculous.
It's always a thriller between these two. Well, usually a thriller between these two.
Yeah. But Zverev he's completely rattled for some reason. Like, he has him out on his feet, but he's struggling to put him away. It's a bizarre match. I kind of likened it to the Michael Jordan flu game. If Alcaraz manages to pull this off, it's actually extraordinary what he's doing, staying in this game on one leg.
It's one of those sports where if you feel a muscle being pulled or any sort of twinge in a game of this magnitude, you're thinking to yourself, the dream is over here. All the run through the tournament is going to come to an end because of an injury. But
one of the very few books I've read in my life, Andre Agassi's.
Oh yeah.
Read it a couple of months ago.
Is it called Open?
I couldn't tell you what it's called.
It's called Open.
It's
brilliant.
It's mush right on the front, but it's a brilliant, brilliant book.
Yeah.
Really good. Talking about him growing up in Nevada, and when he was going to look for a house, and his dad would walk straight through the house out to the back garden with a tape measure and see if it was big enough for a tennis court, and if it wasn't, he'd just walk out and say not good enough. And it was that drive. His father drove everything. But brilliant book. I wouldn't be a big reader, but the Agassi book is really good.
Yeah, some of the tennis books are brilliant. Conor Nyland, even recently, the Irish player, with another incredible book, The Racket. Zverev has taken that latest game, so 5-4 Zverev with Alcaraz to serve next to stay in this set. So yeah, an incredible game that we're watching in the Australian Open men's semi-final, and Jannik Sinner and Novak Djokovic will get underway around 8:30 or so Irish time this morning, obviously depending on when this game finishes up. World number one Alcaraz aiming to complete his career Grand Slam, and Zverev is the third seed bidding for a first major title after 3 runner-up finishes for him. So really interesting game that we're going to keep an eye on over the next while. And of course, in the women's side of things as well, Aryna Sabalenka will face Elena Rybakina in the Australian Open final, the world number one. Sabalenka keeping her cool to storm past Elena Svitolina and reach a fourth Melbourne showpiece in a row. So that's going to be a brilliant final on the women's side of things as well. The Europa League last night, lads, like some pretty interesting games from an English perspective, I suppose, Premier League perspective. Aston Villa fighting back from 2-0 down to beat Red Bull Salzburg and finished second in the Europa League phase. Ollie Watkins' injury perhaps is the most worrying thing for them. Came off with a hamstring problem, what appeared to be a hamstring problem. Harvey Elliott came in from the cold as well. First appearance in almost 4 months for him. But Watkins joins John McGinn, Youri Tielemans and Boubacar Kamara on the injury list for Aston Villa. That's a bit of a concern for them as they push to, well, I don't know if I can say push to stay in a title race, but I suppose at this point you kind of have to say that.
Yeah, people are telling me that they're in a title race. I know mathematically they're right there with Manchester City and Arsenal, but I expect Villa to fall away. I think their squad strength, when you mention Tielemans and McGinn, McGinn has missed the last three or four. Tielemans has only missed the last two, but I'm not sure how bad those two injuries are, but both of them are absolutely pivotal for what Aston Villa want to do. Unai Emery has won the Europa League four times, so I don't know, would Villa fans be happier isolating that and going all in with that? Because I really don't see them going north of Arsenal or north of Manchester City, to be honest. They're doing brilliantly in the Premier League, but like I say, I expect them to come off the boil ever so slightly, and with the games that they're going to have in the Europa League, that squad is going to become more and more stretched. But brilliant. Did you see the Mings mistake for the first goal?
Yeah.
It's just so indecisive, isn't it? He wants to put his foot on the ball, then he thinks he's going to pass it, then he half-heartedly passes it, and he gets punished. But brilliant recovery from Aston Villa. And I was saying this to you just in the build-up to the show, like the English teams in the Europa League, in the Conference League and in the Champions League, they've got a real chance of doing a clean sweep here. Yeah. Very, very rarely has it ever been done, but all Arsenal, Spurs, Liverpool, Manchester City, Newcastle and Chelsea, all still in the Champions League, Aston Villa and Nottingham Forest in the Europa League, and just Crystal Palace in the Conference League. Got every chance there.
Is that a concern, like for the competitions as a whole, and particularly thinking about the Champions League, when you see so many English teams dominating, it would lead you to maybe worry a little bit about the quality of other divisions. You see the Deloitte, you know, money stat rankings, and I think there were six English teams maybe, or Premier League teams in the top 10. Manchester United, of course, were one of those, but you swap them out for Newcastle and those are the teams essentially that have qualified for the next stage of the Champions League. Like, I don't, it's not a concern obviously for the Premier League teams, they're delighted, but there are certain questions there. You'd wonder about the quality in other tiers.
Yeah, like I think there's only a handful of teams that are actually capable of winning the Champions League this season. When you look at all of the English clubs, I really don't think, I know Spurs fans will say, ah, oh, here's an Arsenal fan having a pop. I don't see Spurs winning the Champions League. I don't particularly see Newcastle or Chelsea. So you've got Arsenal, Liverpool and Manchester City. I see Bayern Munich, PSG and Real Madrid. They're the only ones that can actually go and win the Champions League. People will be saying Barcelona. That high line and back four that they're playing is absolutely mental. So they'll win games because they're talented boys at the top end of the park. But I think when Barcelona come up against an Arsenal or a PSG or somebody who can move the ball really quickly and hurt you in behind, then they will come unstuck. So, yeah, I see a handful of winners, but I see Bayern Munich, PSG and Real Madrid as the only so-called foreign teams that could win it. The rest is Arsenal, Liverpool or Manchester City. I don't see anybody coming from the pack other than them.
Just looking at the odds here for Champions League at the moment, yeah, Arsenal are the favourites. Yeah. Narrowly, of course. But
even as an Arsenal fan, I'm not having that. I know we've been the most impressive. We've been brilliant on paper. We probably are favourites, but PSG, like I know, again, they haven't been great on the eye, but last season they didn't qualify in the top eight and then just caught fire all of a sudden. I think Luis Enrique and that PSG team, when the chips are down, are absolutely mouth-watering. So I understand why Arsenal are favourites, but being an Arsenal fan, I think there's one or two maybe ahead of them. Even Real Madrid haven't been brilliant, but they just got a knack, haven't they, of being able to do it. So, yeah, I think Arsenal are right there, but I'm not having favourites like the optic computer is trying to convince me.
The particular side I'm looking at has Arsenal 7-2 favourites, just ahead of Bayern Munich 4-1. Man City and Barcelona locked at 13-2. Then PSG, almost as the fifth favourites at 15-2. You've Liverpool then ahead of Real Madrid.
Jeez.
Liverpool 9-1, Real Madrid 11-1. Maybe that's because, you know, Real shipped four goals obviously against Benfica during the week and didn't look that dangerous, but it is a hard year to call for the Champions League. I wouldn't like to be sticking my pin to the wall in any team.
It always is so hard at this stage as well. It's so far away, the final. It's so far away. Like, there is no real front runner. Arsenal's the only team that's kind of been consistent throughout. But again, it feels like it's a lot for them to do on a season like this, where it feels like they finally might get over that hump of the Premier League and win it. To win the Champions League as well in that season feels like a lot. That's a lot on your plate.
Well, I was asking you, Keith, before the show, as an Arsenal fan, would you prefer to win the Premier League or the Champions League? It's whatever the opposite of Sophie's choice is, it's a lovely decision to have to make. But
Honestly, off the top of my head, in my own opinion, I'd like to win the Champions League just because Arsenal have never done it. But I realise that if we do win the Champions League and don't win the Premier League, then, you know, Gary Neville is going to start and we're a gang of butlers and we're this, that and the other. Yet I don't understand. The narrative since November has been, it's Arsenal to Lewis. Really? In November? Like, we've started the wind-up here pretty early. So there's still 15 games to go. That's 45 points to play for. Arsenal only 4 points ahead. Mm. They've got the North London Derby. They've got Manchester City away. They've still got Newcastle to play. They'll have Champions League games all in the middle of this. The one thing that can't happen from an Arsenal point of view this season is that we get to the end of the season and we haven't won a thing. Because we've been brilliant for so long. And again, even if we do, I'm saying it can't happen, but if it does happen, I'm not saying that's it, Mikel Arteta needs to go, upend everything, it's not right. We're moving in the right direction. We're very, very close. There's a lot of other good teams around, especially in Europe, one or two in the Premier League. So if we don't win a trophy this season, I mean the Champions League or the Premier League, it will leave a sour taste, but I'm still convinced that Arsenal are going in the right direction. We have stability. We're able to attract big names to the club because people either buy into what Mikel Arteta is doing or they don't. I mean, you look at United with Carrick. Can he really go out and get signings given the fact that he's an interim manager? Glasner at Crystal Palace, he's not going to be there. So I think it takes a long time to turn the club in the right direction. And for me, Arsenal are going in the direction and the grass is not always greener on the other side. And again, I don't see a ready-made replacement, like a top manager out of work that you think, go and get him, he'll be a success.
You're saying they have to win a trophy. How would you assess a season? Again, we're working on hypotheticals here. Where Arsenal finish second in the league, they lose the Champions League final, but then they win the Carabao Cup and the FA Cup. They win two trophies.
I know.
Just not the ones they wanted.
Well, I can already hear the Spurs fans, because last season Spurs fans were trying to convince me they had a better season because they won a trophy and Arsenal finished second. I was thinking, get down off of that. To be honest, again, it's not ideal. But if we were to be really close in the Champions League and be beaten in the final, go close in the Premier League and pick up one of the lesser trophies, yeah, I still think we're going in the right direction. And it's not the silverware we want, but it's a little bit of silverware. Just pick up something. Pick up something and go close. And I'm convinced we're still going in the right direction. And it's a bit of a wild one that will probably come back to bite me on the arse on Monday morning. I think Arsenal will go 7 points clear in the Premier League by Monday morning.
Really?
Yeah, I think Leeds against Arsenal, I fancy Arsenal to go and beat them. I know Leeds are unbeaten in the last five league home games. But I think going to Elland Road now has a bit of spice on it. I know it always did notoriously back in the day, but Leeds are viewed as a team that's just been promoted and maybe an easy touch. That's changed over the last 6 to 8 weeks. Calvert-Lewin has started scoring goals. So there's a little bit of stuff there for Arsenal where they will show respect. And I wouldn't be surprised if Spurs go and beat Manchester City. I know Spurs at home have been absolutely awful, but they're just one of those teams that I think they're Manchester City's bogey team. So I think Arsenal will win. And I have a feeling Manchester City are going to lose. And there's that 7 point gap again, and everybody be convincing me to be shaking my hand, going, you have won it again, it's over, don't worry about it. But I still think there's going to be loads of ups and downs and twists and turns, and Arsenal might even go second and then go back first. I don't think it's going to be an easy one till the end.
I was just looking at the next five fixtures for both teams, for Arsenal and City. Arsenal have Leeds obviously at the weekend away, Sunderland at home, this is just Premier League, Brentford away, Tottenham away, and then Chelsea at home. Man City have a tough run as well. Tottenham, Liverpool away, Fulham home, Newcastle at home, and then Leeds away. It's like, both teams, like, it's going to go either way, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also think, like, the Leeds, there's something in my head about, and there's no stats to back this up, something in my head about Leeds half 12 kickoff. I know it's 3 o'clock tomorrow.
Yeah.
Just the way the sun is in the sky in Elland Road at half past 12 compared to what it is at 3 o'clock.
I think you're saying, as a Man United fan, you're saying that because we always have to play them
for policing reasons at half past 12.
Yeah. Yeah. I always loved playing in Elland Road under the lights. There was something about the Champions League back in the day with Harry Kewell and all that. I got the chance to play at Elland Road under the lights, and it's bringing a lot of Leeds fans in my family as well. So always a big one. But look, I'm saying I fancy Spurs to go and do something against Manchester City. If they don't, if Spurs get beat by Manchester City, they then got Manchester United, then they've got Newcastle, then they've Arsenal. If Thomas Frank doesn't come out with a handful of points in those games, he could easily lose his job because he feels like he's already on borrowed time. So Spurs absolutely desperate for the points and probably looking over the shoulder at the likes of the bottom three that are still sneaking. I think they're 8 points ahead of West Ham, and West Ham seem to be clicking into a bit of gear. Spurs are standing still, so they need the points, and I think they'll get them against City, and Thomas Frank needs them.
Yeah, and the dangerous thing here for the Tottenham hierarchy is if you're planning to sack Thomas Frank at some stage before the end of the season, maybe at some stage in the next 4 to 6 weeks, you have to pick your moment. Like, generally you want to sack someone maybe after a tough run of fixtures to get them those defeats out of the way. But obviously United did it differently. Amorim kind of dug his own grave, but Carrick comes in ahead of City and Arsenal, and you're thinking this is going to be a horrible first couple of games for him. So it's tough for hierarchies to know when to pull the plug. So for Thomas Frank, like, he could go and do really well out of these few difficult games, or he could absolutely tank.
There's two different ways of looking at it, isn't there? You could come in as Carrick and win two games that people didn't think you were going to win, and your stock is really, really high. Or you can come in like Wilfred Nancy and be absolutely awful. I know they played Hearts, they played Roma, they had some difficult, difficult games. They had a final in there against St Mirren. So it can be make or break. So, you know, I still maintain that Thomas Frank is a brilliant manager and a good tactician. I know Spurs fans aren't happy with the way they play, but, you know, they finished really, really low down in the Premier League last season, and all of a sudden Spurs fans are saying we should be in a Champions League race this one. Really? That's a hell of an improvement in one season. And look, they've been brilliant in the Champions League, so that to me tells me that the levels are high and they can reach it. I know the home form in the Premier League hasn't been great. Some of the performances in the Premier League hasn't been great, but I still think they're starting to go in the right direction. From Ange to Thomas Frank, it's a total turnaround. So time, patience is going to be a big one. I know we don't really get that in football, but I still maintain if Thomas Frank gets enough time, he'll be a success.
Just to mention the other results in the Europa League last night, some of the interesting games. Celtic with a 4-2 win at home to FC Utrecht. Interesting game as well. Celtic with a 3-0 lead inside the first 19 minutes. Benjamin Nygren, Nick Vierga for own goal, and an Arne Engels penalty. And Utrecht hit back a couple of goals in quick enough succession. But then they get the goal from Trusty to kind of put the game to bed. And Celtic will now face either Stuttgart or Robbie Keane's Ferencvaros in the knockout playoff round of the Europa League. So that'll be fascinating. Martin O'Neill up against Robbie Keane potentially in that one. The draw will be made, of course, later on this afternoon. While for Nottingham Forest last night, Igor Jesus scored twice as they rounded off the league phase with the comfortable win against Robbie Keane's Ferencvaros at the City Ground. The hosts had already secured their place in the knockout round playoffs and went into the game with a small chance of making the top eight. That didn't happen, but look, they'll have that two-legged playoff to make the last 16. So Igor Jesus with two goals in that 4-0 win for Forest over Ferencvaros. So some really interesting games. We've got some comments in as well on the YouTube channel, plenty of them, Dara, as well. One in particular on the, I think someone had mentioned the Benfica game.
Yeah
during the week.
How are Keenan asking Keith your thoughts on it,
on the Benfica
Trouben goal? Yeah,
keeper scoring, I mean, it's just,
you love to see it,
like, you love to see
you
it.
Love to see
yeah
it.
To be fair, I'm a fan of Mourinho's. I love him. I think when he's in the Premier League, wherever club he's at, he gives you a little bit like Duffer when he was at Shelbourne. Even if the game is a bit poor, he'll give you something. Give you something to go on. And yeah, I thought it was brilliant when they threw the goalkeeper up front. Initially it was 3-2, and I'm thinking, why are they throwing the goalkeeper up front? They're beating Real Madrid. You could counter-attack here, but what a header, by the way.
Yeah,
brilliant. I was trying to find out if he played up front growing up or something, because it was a bit too natural. Like, it was like, I don't know, that he's been practicing that.
It's ridiculous.
He's been training for that.
I was listening to the journalist Archie Rindtut, who was at the game, speaking on Football Weekly this week, and he was kind of saying how the vibe in the stands, certainly the fans in the stands, knew that Benfica needed an extra goal, that they were behind Marseille by a goal. If they got one more goal, they would, you know, take that 24th spot ahead of Marseille. But the actual team, like, Mourinho came out afterwards and essentially said he didn't really have a clue. And the goalkeeper said as late as the 93rd minute, he was completely oblivious to why the fans were so excited in the stands and encouraging the team on. He thought maybe it was because, look, team are about to play, or about to beat Real Madrid 3-2. It's a really good result. They hadn't played Madrid in a long, long time. But then the message seemed to filter through that, Jesus, we need another goal here. Mm-hmm. Or else we need Marseille to concede again, but we need to go up and spur the moment. He obviously runs forward and the rest is history. It was just... Yeah. An unbelievable moment.
Even Mourinho running around with the ball boy as well. It's just classic Mourinho, wasn't it? It's the sort of things you remember him doing at Chelsea when he was the special one. I honestly don't think anybody will be fearing Benfica in the Champions League knockout phases, but brilliant win over Real Madrid. And again, there's so much talent in that Real Madrid team that they could still easily go on and win the Champions League. But yeah, brilliant. Brilliant from Mourinho. Great memories.
Anatoly Trubin, the name of the Ukrainian goalkeeper who scored the goal, by the way, just to give him his dues. Like, there was some serious... Let us know in the comments, by the way, the best goalkeeper goal of all time. Obviously, the Alisson. I know that wasn't in front against of the crowd. West Brom, it was in the COVID years. But Schmeichel scored one, I think, at some point in his career. He got a brilliant header at one stage, I think, or a goal that was disallowed.
He got a scissor kick against Aston Villa at the back post.
That might have been it. Didn't the keeper hit... Who was the goalkeeper in the last 10, 15 years who scored from not from a kick out, but a free kick or something from distance? You know what?
Begovic scored one.
Was it Begovic? Bounces over the keeper.
Yeah, I remember where I was when I found out. I wasn't watching the game, but I was in the O'Neill's in Enniskillen. You know that big shop in Enniskillen?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw it on the TV. It must have just been Sky Sports on. And it came up minute one. Asmir Begovic, and I was like, what? what's happened here? I had to look it up. I was like, oh my god.
I'm just looking up six of the best. So Peter Schmeichel scored for Aston Villa against Everton, the first keeper in Premier League history to score a goal, scored for Villa in a 3-2 defeat by Everton, came up for a corner in the closing minutes, ball rebounds towards him, smashed into the top corner. He scored 9 goals in his career.
Schmeichel did. He scored more than me.
Must have been a few for Brondby in there as well. I'm just going to check his stats here, but Schmeichel, yeah, he was definitely known for them. For Hvidovre, apologies to anyone from that Danish, presumably, town. 78 appearances, 6 goals. And then for Brondby, 119 appearances and 2 goals. And then the 1 goal for Aston Villa as well in his career. And 1 goal for Denmark in 129 caps for Peter Schmeichel. So that's some record. Paul Robinson is the one I was thinking about. 2007, scored the second goal of his career in Tottenham's 3-1 win against Watford. 90-yard free kick, caught Ben Foster out and hops over.
Paul Robinson, I played with him at Blackburn.
Yeah, brilliant keeper.
Yeah, he was a good goalkeeper. We had a replica on the training ground. It was inch for inch the same as Ewood Park, and we trained on that on a Friday. I remember I was playing in the number 10. I was, whatever the opposition was on the Saturday, I was, Keith, just get the ball in the number 10 and we're going to see if the centre-half comes with you and what the centre midfielders do. I got fouled deep in my own half. And the manager said, right, the starting team now has this free kick, and what we're going to do, Paul, you come out and take the free kick, about 30 yards outside the box. He was like, just lump it in, Chris Samba into the box. But that boy could fire the ball at least 100 yards. Like, anywhere we got a free kick in our half, Paul Robinson would take a free kick, and it was going straight into the 18-yard box. But yeah, nice bloke, Paul. Spent a good bit of time with him at Blackburn.
One of those lads who could have been called up to the NFL, one of these drafts for kickers. Like, he's got a serious boot on him. Rory Beggin sort of kick. Brad Friedel is another. 2004, Brad Friedel became only the second keeper in Premier League history to get in the score sheet. Equalised in the 90th minute at Charlton, but then conceded a dramatic winner moments later to ruin it.
Jesus, Brad scored in the Premier League.
There you go, yeah. Brad Friedel, 2004.
I like how you somehow managed to weasel in a Monaghan player.
Thought you might like
done all that somehow.
Yeah, could have said Charlie Smith, of
Keith
course.
Didn't even notice it.
Yeah,
I'm still baffled. I think I was at Blackburn in 2004.
Were you, right?
I have no idea that Brad scored.
I'll get the teams. 2004, Blackburn, Charlton. Friedel goal. Because if you were on the pitch, I asked you this morning, Keith.
Yeah.
Were you ever on the pitch when a goalkeeper scored? I've got the teams here. So Charlton 3, Blackburn 2. Klaus Jensen scored the last minute goal after Brad Friedel. It's... equalised. Blackburn team: Friedel, Babel, Short, Todd, replaced by York, Gray, Neil, Flitcroft, two guy came on, Emerton, Douglas, Jonathan Douglas, I think.
Jonathan
another
Douglas,
Monaghan,
yeah,
man, another Monaghan man. Gallagher, Stead, replaced by Cole, and then subs not used: Enkelman and Anderson. So,
oh, that was when there was only 5 subs.
Must have been.
Yeah, back in the day. Yeah.
So you weren't either. You hadn't joined yet.
I probably just didn't make the first team at that point. But yeah, I think I went in 2003. So
right, okay,
I would have been at Blackburn.
Yeah.
Yeah,
somewhere in the back recesses of your memory, somewhere there.
Speaking of Blackburn, I don't know if you've seen this morning that they're in a legal dispute with their kit sponsor.
Yeah.
Macron, which is just
bizarre.
Hey, this is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. Back in 2011, I was fed up, sick of cheap disposable clothes that fell apart after a few washes, and even more sick of the fact that almost nothing good was made here anymore. So I started American Giant to prove something, that we could still make the absolute best hoodies, t-shirts, and pants right here in America, with American cotton, American factories, and American workers earning real wages. We exist to bring manufacturing home, create good jobs in towns that need them, and build clothes that actually last. No shortcuts, no overseas compromises. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com.
Characteristic of their season so far as well. They've been having a tough time, haven't they?
Yeah, I
second.
Think I got out of Blackburn at just the right time. The Venkies were coming in when I left to go to Preston, and I remember one of my last games there, there was chickens running around on the pitch and all. People used to smuggle chickens in because the Venkies got their money through chickens. So every time you'd be kick-off, there'd be chickens running around
protest.
On the pitch. Yeah, just people, like fans would bring them in and mess and want the Venkies out. And yeah, I just remember loads of chickens running around Ewood Park for a while. It was it was crazy.
How do you smuggle in a chicken?
I didn't do it. I just seen the chickens. Before.
Sorry, yeah, of course.
Like mad, on the last day of secondary school, not me, of course, but lads used to bring in. Well, you'd hear stories of people bringing in a pig, or a small pig with oil or Vaseline or something coated all over it, so that the anyone trying to catch it was obviously too slippery to catch. Would never condone such a thing myself, but I've heard such a thing happen in school in my home area.
Imagine that being your day's work. What have you been doing today? Just trying to catch a greased up pig?
Yeah. Not easy. Not easy. By the way, Alexander Zverev has taken the fourth set in a tiebreak, 7-6, to force a deciding set. Another five-set thriller. It's going to be Carlos Alcaraz against Alexander Zverev.
What's happening is literally Alcaraz has just taken his own serve, and Zverev's taken his own serve. So whoever goes first is just going to win.
It's going to be a long final set, potentially.
Yeah.
If it keeps going like that. So, yeah, really interesting stuff. The Australian Open semi-final, we'll keep on top of that one. So, there's a couple of other talking points as well from during the week. An interesting talking point from Roy Keane that I want to get both of your views on. He was chatting on the overlap this week about, now maybe it's a veiled dig at someone, but he said that he would rather have got zero international caps than one international cap. I think his point being that if you get one international cap, you're brought in, they take a look at you, they throw you off the bench, and then they say, nah, he's not for me, never again. Can you see what he's talking? I don't get his point at all. I think to pull on the jersey of your country, even for 30 seconds, and to give yourself a cap would be such a huge honour for you and your family and your club and all the rest. But can you see what he's getting at?
Not really. I think Roy has become a little bit numb. Like the things he's achieved in his career, what he did for Ireland, and I know we could have done an awful lot more for Ireland. I think he's just become numb to what he's achieved. And like any other player, I mean, I got six caps for Ireland, and you know, some of the best memories of my career were playing for Ireland. I was only ever a fringe player, but it means the world to me that I did get into that Irish team. And I sort of understand what he means, that, you know, you come in, they have a little look at you, you get that one cap, and if you never come back, it's like they've said, nah, you're not really for us, which, I don't know, it just doesn't sit well with me belittling people's achievement. If anybody had one kick of a ball for Ireland, England, Spain, the Republic of the Congo, whoever it is, it's an achievement to becoming an international footballer. So I don't like the undertone of belittling it, but I sort of understand what Roy means. That's sort of what Roy does, isn't it? He sort of says something, you go, there's an air of truth to that, but I'm still not quite happy with how it's been delivered. And yeah, I don't like the undertone of, you know, belittling somebody's achievement.
I don't know if you saw during the week, we had Joe Murphy, the journeyman goalkeeper.
Oh yeah.
On the green scene with Matthew Brennan earlier in the week. And he has two caps for Ireland, 7 years apart.
Yeah.
But you know, we got voice notes sent in from Kevin Kilbane and lads that he played with in the Ireland camp. He'd been in loads of Ireland camps. Mm. So I think there's much more to a cap than just the actual time spent on the field. There's a lot to be taken from the experience in general. And you'd know that yourself.
Yeah.
Like being in camps and being around better players and international players. Like, it's, yeah, I think that, as you say, I think it's belittling, really.
Yeah.
Down to just
I wanted to text Cullum. I was watching when Joe was on. I played against Joe, and Cullum asked me, so have you ever played against Joe? And I went through my memory bank, and I ended up thinking Preston played Scunthorpe, sorry, whenever it was, 2010, 2011 in Deepdale. And it was like a relegation playoff. Whoever loses this is going to be further in the mire, and the other team will just ease out of it. And where I played in the number 10, I think David Unsworth was the manager, and he played me in the number 10. I set a goal for John Park, and we're actually doing okay. I think it was 2-1 to us with a minute to go. Sean St. Ledger gives a dodgy back pass, and it's 2-2. And it's 2-1 to Scunthorpe after the dodgy back pass, and it's the 88th minute, and we're thinking, we're really struggling here. We're going to have to win every game. Like, I think there's 6 games to go. We're going to have to win every game to get out of this. And a couple of minutes later, Billy Jones gives me the ball. I cut inside and I put it in the top corner. Mm. It was Joe. Joe was in goal at the time, yeah.
Really?
So that's one of my memories with Joe. But I think every Irish player who went across the water has come across Joe. The longevity, I think everybody would have nice words to say about him as well. Just a real level-headed, humble guy, and somebody that I think every Irish player has come across him and likes him. Like, Kevin Kilbane giving voice notes about him doesn't surprise me whatsoever.
And you see that with goalkeepers a lot too. Like, I'm thinking at Manchester United, Tom Heaton is someone who, and you'd have known Tom Heaton as well, who maybe only has an appearance or two for the first team for Manchester United in this stint, and yet every single player, when they're asked about the biggest impact in the dressing room, he's one of the names that comes up.
Yeah,
because obviously sometimes you're worth more than the minutes you have on the pitches.
Yeah. David Ford.
Yeah.
He would have been around the Ireland squad an awful lot, didn't get an awful lot of caps. I think his first cap, he was north of 30 by the time he started playing. So, yeah, it doesn't really matter to me whether you have 100 caps or one cap. I still think it's an achievement. 100 caps is obviously a lot better than one cap, but still both achievements that you can go and tell your grandkids about.
Yeah, 100%. And in fairness, Roy Keane's, is it his son-in-law or future son-in-law, Taylor Harwood Bellis, who plays for Southampton, one appearance for England, that appearance against Ireland, and he scored a goal.
Jesus, them Christmas dinners must be awful. No one really said stuff like that, and you're Harwood, you're looking across going, does he think I'm a journeyman?
He does not rate me.
Not at all. In fairness to Taylor Harwood Bellis, he's 23, so he's plenty of time to add to those caps if he wants, potentially. There's loads of other bits. Just to retouch on the Champions League as well, that I've seen some people giving out about the format quite heavily this week, that look, there was, 18 games to follow, and unless you're watching the goal show, it's absolutely impossible to follow the games too well, and you're missing out on key moments. Maybe some people would have missed out on that Benfica goalkeeper scoring. Some people would have missed out on Bodo Glimt and their incredible story winning at Atletico Madrid. Can you see people's arguments, or is the other argument that, look, none of us would have been interested in a battle between Benfica and Marseille for a 24th position only for this?
I like it. I like the new format, I have to say. I do think, I was listening to Miguel Delaney talking about and saying, other than the last game on Wednesday, there was no real jeopardy for the big teams. They think, if we lose this, we'll win the next one, or we'll win our home games. I understand that argument, but it still throws up big, big games. I mean, early on in the competition, Arsenal played Bayern Munich.
Yeah.
And I know mathematically either team can lose that and still recover. PSG lost a couple of games last season and still recovered to go on and win it. I think we're getting bigger games more often, and I know it is a little bit tailored towards the last game and there's 18 and you can lose stuff in the amount of games. But I'm enjoying it, I have to say. I mean, the group stages, you probably get one decent game out of every group during the group stages. Yeah. And even then, you think, if you lose to the big team, we'll beat the other two lower teams. I preferred it this way, I have to say. I think it's been revamped and I'm enjoying it. And I still think the bigger teams are still getting the grips with it. The best thing to do is go out and get points on the board and then spin your wheels towards the end. But yeah, I'm enjoying it, I have to say. It's been revamped and I think for the better.
What do you think about the games only on Wednesday in the last round of this stage, as opposed to having Tuesday and Wednesday?
I suppose they have, because of the nature, it's like the end of the National Leagues and GA, you kind of have to put them all on one of the nights in case of a Benfica Marseille eventuality, that one team needs an extra goal. And so I can understand, but it is a lot. It would be so much more exciting to be able to watch, say, keep an eye on nine games versus 18 games all at once.
Yeah.
But it's a difficult one. I know money is at the crux of all of this for UEFA as well. I mean, the amount of games that they're bringing in cash for it. It probably makes sense. It's a cash king for them, as well, a cash cow for them at the minute. But yeah, we'll see what happens in the next couple of years. But
it worked out, to be fair, the way it all happened. And obviously the Benfica goal was the last action of the night. It did work out in the end, but if some of those games were 0-0 draws and not that exciting, you'd be a bit like,
yeah,
probably could have spaced these out a little bit.
Yeah, not a fair point. We'll obviously chat to Mike Sherry on rugby later on as well, but Dara, the Bundee Aki stuff from this week is just extraordinary. So banned for four games by the URC Disciplinary Committee after abusing match officials while playing for Connacht, and talked that some of this abuse, if you call it that, led to discussions after the match and conversations after the match between Bundee Aki and officials. So he'll miss Ireland's opening three Six Nations games anyway against France, Italy and England. I suppose the moral here is don't talk back to match officials.
Yeah, I suppose everyone's seen the news now, but just to recap, there was a few incidents during the game. Bundee and Jack Carty were noted to be given some grief to the ref for certain decisions, and the report was that this continued after the game, and Bundee allegedly approached an official after the game, which is obviously a big no-no in any sport, really. There's protocols for these type of things, and if you want to raise issues or any concerns before and after a game, you do so through the correct processes. But that's obviously where the ban came from. So he was banned for 6 weeks, suspended to four. So one will count for this weekend for Connacht, and then he'll miss the first three games of the Six Nations. Now, I would have thought when this news came out, I was like, there's no way they're going to bring him back into the Six Nations camp, because as it looks like the IRFU aren't very happy with him, particularly because it was an Irish referee. So that rubbed them off the wrong way, naturally enough. But Andy Farrell's insisting that there is a way back for him in the squad after the suspension. So we'll see what happens there. But now it looks like a door has opened for a couple of players as well. So Stuart McCluskey obviously is expected to start at 12. Now, I think he probably was the front runner
anyway.
But obviously eliminate some competition for him at that position. But then obviously Jude Postlethwaite called up from Ulster as well. So he's in line to make his first cap potentially in the Six Nations, which is obviously great for him. There's an opportunity for another player when these type of things happen, but it's not what you want to see happen with a player like Bundee, who's been so key to all of Ireland's success over the last best part of 10 years, really. It's disappointing, and you know, you just hope that that's the end of it, that he kind of comes out, apologises.
Back into the fold then.
Yeah, and then that's it, and we move on.
If this was a footballer getting banned for speaking to a referee, you'd be thinking that must have been
bad.
Abuse
really
for,
bad,
for a player. But for a rugby player, could it have been...
Maybe not that bad.
Yeah, like a little bit lighter, but talking to the referee in general is just, it's just a no-no.
Yeah, like, I don't think... He definitely didn't get banned because of what happened on the pitch. It was definitely the confrontation that's supposed to have happened after.
At a dinner or this.
Yeah, sort of that was the setting.
After the match.
Yeah, he approached...
So maybe the environment in which he approached the referee. The game's over. You know, everyone's relaxing after the game, having a bit of food, and maybe it was the approach there. Look, I'm speculating.
Yeah, I was actually in, so the week of the Leinster game, I did a tour with a few other journalists in the new Dexcom stand, and there's this lovely kind of hospitality area, I suppose. It's nearly like a canteen upstairs, and I presume that's where all this happened. That was the report. And I think, what seems to have happened is that he approached Owen Cross, the referee, during this dinner or event. And that's just, you just don't do that.
Like, you're
not getting away with that. But it was funny because I actually saw Jude Postlethwaite. I was in the airport on Monday, as luck happens, and I saw Jude Postlethwaite with the Irish squad. So I'd mentioned that on the show during the week, but didn't obviously know the reason behind it. Maybe thought they needed extra cover or something, or someone was carrying an injury of some sort. But it came out obviously during the week that Bundee had been dropped from the squad altogether. It's a really interesting. We're not used to it, as rugby fans.
Rugby, definitely
not. You don't see it. You really don't see it. Like, these things normally get dealt with on the pitch, and players get disciplined on the pitch, and that's kind of the end of it. It's very rare. I suppose you might think of Mac Hansen last year in December.
Yeah.
Spoke out in a press conference against one of the referees against Leinster as well, as it happens in the Aviva Stadium. He got banned for 3 weeks, I believe it was, and then Sexton, obviously, after the 2023 European Cup final. That's well documented that he also received a ban for abuse directed towards the officials after the game during half time, I think, as well. But outside of those incidents, I don't think we've ever seen anything like it. But yeah, there's plenty of news coming out there. Out of the Erle camp, Hugo Keenan obviously seems to be done for the Six Nations with a broken thumb.
Yeah,
which is
a massive blow.
So unfortunate. And it was a non-contact drill he was doing. I think it was one of the first drills he's done with the Ireland camp, if not the first one. Since
so non-contact drill is essentially ball work.
Yeah, it seems like he's jammed his thumb or something, and you know, it went the wrong way or something like that. We don't really know the details of it, but extremely unfortunate in its nature. Which now that leaves a big hole, a fullback really, I suppose. He hadn't played since the Lions, so the position was still up for grabs, but it definitely cuts down our options for sure. So Stockdale seems to be the name on people's lips, but Jamie Osborne coming back as well, hasn't played in months either. He got injured obviously in that Japan game in November, so it's really, really up in the air. And it's just like, did we have to get France in the first game? Could we not have been given a slightly easier game?
I've heard of people making the argument, would have been nicer to get Italy in the first game and kind of warm your way into it. But then in some ways...
But if you lose that game, I suppose, then it's an absolute disaster.
That's the thing. Yeah. But then maybe, look, getting France first, instead of France, it can't get any more difficult
it's
than
a
that.
Baptism
so
of fire.
Exactly, and see where they land. But yeah. I heard Gerr asking Alan Quinlan the question yesterday about, could this be one of the old school games where France put 40 points on Ireland? I can't see it getting that bad, but I think the bookmakers do have maybe a 13-point spread. But this is definitely France's lose.
That was my feeling a few weeks out, and it's even more potent at this stage now with all the injury concerns. Now, France have their own injury concerns as well, but their depth is just ridiculous.
Mm.
Like, they're missing two of their top scrum halves in Legarec and Lukaku, but then they obviously still have Dupont, who's come back now from injury, and then Baptiste Ferran, who's like a French legend, is back in the squad now, so it's like, okay, they'll be fine. They'll be all right.
I enjoyed the, was it Quinny saying, I remember when I was playing underage football years ago, the only time I was ever yellow carded while not playing, the game was over, and we were walking back to the dressing rooms, and I had a couple of words with, I think it was maybe under 15s or something, a couple of words with the referee, but a couple of decisions, and yeah, he booked me just as I was walking into the dressing room. Game over. But I just thought that was I obviously wouldn't drop it, maybe. You know, you just won't leave it.
Do you have to pay for that?
It's a good question.
When we got done for descent at Blackburn, we had to pay. Anything that wasn't a tackle, we had to pay. And do you know how much the fine was for the FA?
How much?
£8. £8.
Really?
I used to see it on the end of my wage.
For a booking?
£8 for a descent to the referee.
Right. Where does that go? Like, what's that put towards?
I don't know. Yeah, but Blackburn made it pretty clear that anything for descent comes out of your wages. Now, it wasn't a big hit, but it was just the principle of it that we're not taking that.
Yeah.
You get a red card for a bad tackle, no problem, but not giving out to the referees.
Yeah.
Were you a man for a yellow card? Like, would you have picked up many?
Yeah, I would have got a couple of yellow cards. I've been sent off a handful of times as well.
For anything major or two yellows?
It was two yellows, but it's hard to... I was bad with referees. I would, you know, anything would come flying out of my mouth at the time. I remember Derby County got a penalty against Burnley, and it was Jason Shackle won the ball, and then it was a sliding tackle, but as he wins the ball, he follows through and takes one of the Derby players out, but clearly gets the ball, and the referee gives a penalty. And the referee had there was two brothers that used the referee in the championship, and I looked at him and thought, why do we always get the bad referees? And I could see his face sort of drop, because it wasn't really, you know, I wasn't being aggressive. I just looked at him, why do we always get the bad ones? And I seen a Hortum 10 days later in Turf Moor. We were playing West Ham in the FA Cup, and I don't know who it was. Was it Collins rounded Tom Heaton? He's about to tap it into the back of the net, and they're already winning 1-0, so I clicked his heels just as he's about to put it in the back of the net. Got sent off, but it was the same referee.
Oh.
And I'm looking at him saying, I'm already on a yellow, and I've just given away a penalty in the last minute. And I looked at him and said, there's no need. You don't need to send me off. The game's over. And the smile from ear to ear as he took the red card out. I thought, shares me right. Shares
he,
me
he
right.
Enjoyed that one. Yeah.
But Dyche was delighted. I thought, I'm going to get it off. Dyche, he looked at me and said, I can't believe you were running that hard in the 94th minute of the game, son.
Yeah.
But I missed the next three, so... Yeah, hurt me in the end.
It's not a bad one. I remember it was the famous Ole Gunnar Solskjaer one years ago for United, where he was a clear goal or one-on-one, and I can't remember who was it, Newcastle or someone he was against, and sprints the whole leg of the pitch just to hack the legs from one man and obviously takes the red card and he gets a standing ovation going off.
Yeah.
Solskjaer, it's one of those good fouls that it's guaranteed goal, so you might as well take the red.
To be fair, in hindsight, thinking about it, Dyche said to me after, he said, if you hadn't got the red, you'd have played next week. So I thought, should have just left it. But you know, at the time, you just see an empty net and the boy about to pass it in, and you do what you can. But
yeah, he was happy enough with me.
Yeah, it's funny in rugby as well. Like Quinny mentioned yesterday how in the AIL they used to, maybe they still do, call the referee sir.
Yeah, yeah.
Real kind of.
Sure. I've played a decent bit at Leinster, and like everyone else around me says, most lads played schools rugby, and it seems to be kind of a thing. But like when you're training, I suppose your coach is also your like headmaster and teachers, yeah. And they just call them sir.
Could you call your headmaster in school sir or teachers?
I think, yeah, I would have called my principal sir for sure.
I think we called in our school, it wasn't a posh school by any stretch, but secondary school, we called teachers sir as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were generally, sir. Yeah. Yeah.
But calling a referee sir is...
No, I never, extra, never.
That's real Leinster school.
Never really have gotten into that now. I don't really understand it. I don't get it.
Like, I say I was bad with refs, but Burnley played Preston in the Lancashire Derby, and we got Howard Webb, and he refereed, and he was absolutely brilliant. He stood at the start of the tunnel, and he basically said, look, lads, this is a derby. It's going to be physical. I'm going to let a couple of tackles go. And I thought I was fouled during the game, and I started giving him a bit. And he literally came over to me and said, put your hands by your side. Don't be waving your arms, Keith. And he said, what's wrong with you? I said, that was a foul. That was this and that. And he went, okay, maybe it was. Next time, it does a 50-50. I'll give it to you. How do you argue with that?
Yeah.
Look, I'm in the hide of it. I'm Hank Howard. And you run off. And yeah. Brilliant, brilliant referee. Most referees come over and as you're giving out, they say, shut up, get away from me, I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And it just infuriates you more. But Howard Webb was, with his words, could just dismantle you. He was brilliant.
Fascinating.
And he would always call you by your name. Even though he was a Premier League referee that came down to the Championship, he would say Keith. Like most referees say number 11. You're thinking, it just doesn't sit well with you. Like, what do you mean number 11? Howard Webb, probably the best referee I've had.
Right.
Just dismantling people with words.
Shows
calming things down.
Saying the player's name is a nice little touch as well. Brilliant stuff.
He's real nostalgic for me. Like when I think about him, I think of proper Premier League fixtures. Like
Bartley's. Bartley's.
That was a good era.
Yeah, a brilliant era. We've loads of questions in the YouTube comments that we'll come back to when Barry Murphy is with us as well for Keith. One of them, Keith, that you can have a think about. Question for Keith. Do you think Deitch has the minerals to manage a big six or top four club? I'll have a think of that one for the next while as well. We'll come back to some of those questions on our YouTube channel. Keep the comments coming in. It's myself and Keith and Dara. We're on the air until around 9:40, 9:45 or so this morning on the show. We've got loads still to come. As I said, Barry Murphy at around 8:45 a.m. Mike Sherry to talk rugby at 9:15. And then Dara's chat with Piers O'Connor of Edinburgh is to come at around 9:40 or so as well.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
Ireland's Sports Breakfast Show.